This is the Motion Martial Arts Podcast. In this episode, we talk about the evolution of martial arts and different developments that we notice over time. Thanks for listening.
What's up, everybody?
How's everybody doing during the continuation of this, I guess, coronavirus COVID-19 shutdown?
Lockdown. So I, for one, have been reading a lot of karate books, and today I was thinking it would be cool to talk about how a style evolves over time and how you can compare, you know, the way that karate was practiced, you know, in previous decades to the way that it's typically practiced today, and how drastically things can change in a relatively short period of time. And I'm sure the same thing is true of jiu-jitsu. Look at the evolution of...
Yeah, you know. I think that the two main driving forces for evolution of a martial art is there actually a practical need for it to be used in real life situations day to day? And is there not? And if there's not, that usually leads to it growing more into a sport.
Sure.
So I think those are like the two main things that make styles, I guess, evolve.
I would say there's a third one that... you know, just the concept of it being for health and fitness, which is a very big thing in karate, and one that isn't, that often isn't as clearly understood as I think it should be, that there was a conscious push when karate came to mainland Japan and became big, that it was a lot more about physical and mental development than it was about, you know, like self-defense, like real combat. That was understood by, a lot of key figures from that time period. You know, Gichin Funakoshi, often referred to as the father of modern karate, was a key player there. That he brought karate, he was a school teacher himself, he brought karate to Japan. It's one of, there were other guys, of course, who came, brought karate from Okinawa to Japan, but he was, of course, one of the biggest ones, and very consciously, you know, created a style of karate that was a lot more about athletic development and, you know, mental development than it was about any kind of combat. And I think that that's what happens. And it was after Funakoshi, after that development, where it was kind of about your physical and mental development, that it was his immediate successors, a guy named Nakayama. He was a very big, like, golden age Japanese Karate Association guy that really pushed for the creation of karate as a sport. So, an interesting Olympics. This summer Olympics were supposed to be the first. You know, karate was going to be introduced as an Olympic sport this year, but I think that they've been canceled. It'll be next year.
Yeah, it's already canceled.
No,
it's just summer 2021.
I'm wondering how they're gonna. Is the following Olympics going to be 3 years after that, or are they gonna?
I think it shifts to 3 years. But I mean, who knows? I think it's. Even at this point, who knows if they're going to do it in a year.
Yeah.
Everything's kind of up in the air, obviously.
But anyway, I look at the evolution, the general kind of path I think martial arts take is martial arts created for some form of combat. You know, whether you're talking about defense against, you know, like what we call self-defense, which is like defense against a criminal assault, or like what martial arts really were, you know, before that was like battlefield arts. Then it becomes something that's maybe for health and physical development, which is that, you know, it's a form of exercise and a good thing. And then it becomes something that's like a sport.
Yeah. So I think that every martial arts roots is in that initial thing for real life combat.
Yeah.
But I don't know the answer to this. There's probably are more modern martial arts. So things that are probably less than 50 years old that were created strictly for the health and wellness thing.
Yeah.
And maybe offshoots of some of the martial arts that were created strictly for a sport.
Sure.
But like, I mean, let's first start talking about the combat thing, because I mean, that's kind of, jiu-jitsu is a great example of this, because Japanese jiu-jitsu was originally for the samurais. So it was strictly being used as a wartime martial art. And the evolution of jiu-jitsu and judo is that they were like, well, we are no longer in a time of war.
Yeah.
How do we continue to practice this and make it something that is safer to practice and eventually a spectator sport, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where the evolution of judo comes, and then Japanese jiu-jitsu eventually became Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever read any Jigoro Kano's writings, but, you know, he was very, I think, often underappreciated, specifically in karate circles, how influential Jigoro Kano was. And that, like, the karate uniform, jiu-jitsu uniform too, you know, white gi with colored belts, you know, it's like, that's judo. Comes from judo. They were the first ones to do that. Karate guys just straight up took that and, you know, made it a part of what we do, you know. And he was very clear about, you know, judo being, he was a pioneer in the idea of taking martial arts and making it into something that was for physical and mental development. And it's something that really had spread, you know, across the whole martial arts world. You know, I mean, like karate, very specifically, that's something that karate adopted, and Funakoshi and his contemporaries specifically adopted that idea. The idea we can use martial arts to develop stronger, healthier individuals. And it's a powerful idea, and it's one that shouldn't be, you know, like, I'm a guy, you know, I think that it can go too far often. I think that when martial art gets too removed from actual combat, it starts to become something like, well, why aren't I just doing yoga? You know what I mean? It's like, so it has to have that piece. And I think that's a big movement in modern martial arts today. You know, the idea of wanting to go back to what works and what is practical. And it's very important. However, you know, at the end of the day, I think that everybody can benefit from, you know, being healthier, right? And we've had this conversation plenty of times on the podcast before that, you know, it's all about the way that you train. And martial arts, you know, can break your body very well. You know, if you're not careful about the way that you train, and you don't want to use your training to make yourself healthier, you push yourself too hard, you know, you will injure yourself, and it will not. Martial arts has the potential to make you less healthy.
Here's the thing, though. So I agree that there is a movement of people that are doing it now more and more, kind of like, well, what's actually practical? But I actually think the opposite is happening too, which I think is kind of a bigger worldview picture, period, where I think that the division between groups and motivations are growing wider in everything.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that there is, like, I like using yoga as an example, because I think that there is a group of people that are very much into the idea of doing yoga traditionally.
Yeah.
But I also think that there is a wide group of people, particularly in the United States, where yoga has become a competitive stretching fad. And it has become pretty much everything that yoga was not created to be. And it you see it from everything. It's like a pop culture trend.
Yeah.
Like, yoga is almost like the equivalent of, like, when somebody like the Backstreet Boys become popular. And it just is a sort of lifestyle, sort of everything, from the way these people choose to dress to what drinks they choose to buy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that some of that has happened in martial arts as well.
Oh, definitely.
And I think that there's, like, I notice it somewhat in jiu-jitsu, and I think that if we have some guests on again that of guys that are more old school that have done it for even longer, they're going to say that, talk about how, yeah, like, there is, like, everyday fashion trends now that are part of jiu-jitsu that used to not happen. Like, there's even times sometimes where I catch myself and I'm like, I'm wearing a like, hoodie that says Gracie Jiu-Jitsu on. I'm like, is this actually a good idea?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's actually a good idea. I'm like, I do understand that the chances of me getting into a physical confrontation are probably pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel good about this idea of, like, yes, I'm helping to promote and present this idea of, yes, I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So people might come up and have conversations like, oh, you do that? Where do you do that? That's cool. But at the same time, I'm like, you're also kind of making yourself a billboard for stupid activity, because all it takes is one moron to come up to you and be like, oh, you do that stuff? And then they start to maybe take it too far, and you're lead yourself to a self-defense situation.
Oh yeah, no, that's definitely a topic I've seen talked about in, like, a lot of the self-defense circles before, that, you know, you should not advertise that you are a martial artist all the time, because it's just, yeah, I mean, why? You know, you're putting yourself, it's one of those things where it's like, if you're this, like, if you advertise yourself as a martial artist and some guy wants to test you, and it's like, it's kind of like if he can give you a beating, then it's just like, oh yeah, you know, screw that guy. You know, it's like a beat. It's like, and then if you're able to successfully defend yourself, then it's kind of like, oh well, you know, that guy's a trained martial artist anyway. So okay, so it's just one of those things where it's like, just why? It's just, it's not something that will help. I don't see it as something that's gonna help you like avoid violence. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm not gonna mess with that guy. He's wearing a crazy jiu-jitsu sweatshirt. You know,
yeah, that's the thing. It's pretty much going to lead to one of two results. But if you're somebody who's making better decisions, probably it's just going to be a tool to promote your martial art and get people to talk about it. But
absolutely,
I don't know. Maybe if you're not somebody who still is, you know, more interested maybe in going out on the weekends to a party, or you go to clubs or bars, well, you're wearing your jiu-jitsu shirt, well, there's a chance that somebody who's an idiot, or maybe they're what do they call them, a troll,
right? Yeah,
they're a troll. They want to, so they're it's a billboard to, hey, this is should be the guy I should go pick on.
Sure. Yeah. No. It definitely. I guess an environment like, you know, wearing a karate shirt or jiu-jitsu shirt just in your day-to-day life, like, probably isn't that big a deal. It depends on where you live, I guess. You know, if you're in a safe environment, definitely. But yeah, if you're going out to a bar on the weekend or something like that, you know, it's probably not what you want to be wearing.
Yeah. So let's use Krav Maga as an example, which I think we've talked about before. I don't want to get into a conversation about its effectiveness or not. That's a different conversation for another day. But if you look at how it's used and taught in, you know, Israel, it's extremely different than how it's taught and used here,
because military combatants,
exactly, they're using it to teach their military. It is traditionally for the military, and even though, while I guess they're technically not in a war, they have a lot of violent warlike things that go on there between Palestine. Yeah. Yeah. So again, they're teaching this to the military people with the intention of, you are in a life or death situation. This person is going to cause you great bodily injury.
Yeah.
So you need to cause them great bodily injury or harm before they do that to you. And that's the evolution of that martial art there. But in the United States, it is being marketed as that, but I don't think that it's necessarily being taught sometimes with that same sort of thing. And again, if you're in the military, you probably are more likely to have the ability to turn the switch on to do great bodily armor, kill somebody, versus the everyday person.
Yeah.
If you're in the military, you probably have that switch a little bit more than the everyday person.
Yeah.
So I do think that is a huge influence on how things develop, because Krav Maga, the idea is to maim somebody so badly that you can get out of there, or maim somebody so badly that you can get back to your weapon, or maim them so badly that you can take their weapon away.
And that's probably the one that I feel, and this is true, it's actually true a lot of jiu-jitsu, like talking about Japanese jiu-jitsu, like the jiu-jitsu the samurai would have used a lot. I'm sure it's similar with Krav Maga when you're teaching Krav Maga to like a civilian population. But often when you're talking about something that soldiers essentially are learning, like, what kind of hand-to-hand combat do soldiers need? Like, it's often like, you know, soldiers carry weapons, you know, so exactly. Like, that's it. So, you know, for whatever reason, you don't have a weapon and you're assuming you're being attacked by somebody that does have a weapon. Yeah. Like, that's a military kind of combative type situation. Yeah. And it's not something that's as common that you're going to find like a civilian self-defense type situation. So those are like, I guess, what I imagine would be the first thing that gets dropped is that it's like, you know, you don't have your weapon. You're trying to disarm someone and then kill them with their own weapon. You know, that's the way that Japanese jiu-jitsu is described to me. And I know that on this podcast we've talked about it before. I just find it fascinating that, you know, it's like the reality of the way that, you know, when people would hit swords together on a battlefield, you know, in reality, like, those swords would often break. Yeah. And so that was why, for the samurai, you know, your sword breaks on the battlefield. The grappling that they would practice is, how do you take your opponent's weapon away from them and kill them with it? And, you know, when you compare that to where, and this maybe bring us back a little bit to the idea of the evolution of styles. When you compare that kind of jiu-jitsu, like real, like old school traditional jiu-jitsu with the samurai practice, to like Brazilian jiu-jitsu today. It's like, that's a night and day difference. There's a huge evolution there, well, but again, it's the same martial art.
This leads perfectly into usually the other driving force for the evolution and growth of a martial art, which is the sport.
Yep.
So the second you make something into a sport, the goal is going to be to win.
Yep.
So going back to judo, the concept of the ippon throw is that, you know, if somebody in armor falls or gets taken down in armor, they're dead. Sure. You're not going to get back up on your feet in time. So that's the concept.
I've seen actually some really cool illustrations too, the same way, even with like medieval European illustrations of that. Like, yeah, when you're in armor, the best way to defeat an armored opponent is to knock them over and you stab them under the arm and the neck.
Once you make it into a sport and it becomes popular, well, then you're going to have people that go, well, hey, I am better at nuwaza, which is the ground fighting part of judo.
Yeah.
So instead of actually going for an ippon style takedown that finishes it, I'm going to just figure out a way to drag this down to the ground and take advantage of my ability that I'm better on the ground. Maybe catch them in a headlock and pin them.
Yeah.
You know, so people start to game the system.
Sure. And the idea being as well, that take it to the self-defense aspect, like actual combat aspect of things. I think it was identified that that was also, you know, like the better approach to take. I mean, the reality is that, you know, you throw somebody to the ground, you get that ippon, doesn't mean the fight is necessarily over. Well, you know, it's like that. But
I mean, there's even you know, bigger picture than that. Like, it's not like the samurais were wearing, you can't really easily grab the armor the same way you can a kimono, right?
Sure.
And there's no threat of getting punched or kicked in a judo match, which affects your ability to get grip. So again, like, when it first starts, there's kind of a, oh, this is an effective way to practice our martial art. But then eventually what starts to happen is people start to go, well, if it's a sport, I want to win. I want the glory of winning. I want the glory of victory. So then that alters its trajectory for how it's going to grow, because instead of people going, hey, when I get these grips, I might get headbutted in the face. Mm-hmm. Hey, when I get these grips, I might get kicked. They go, well, if I get headbutted when I get these grips, he's disqualified. So why do I care? I'm just going to get my grips.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think that often, too, the martial art evolves to suit the needs of the people that are practicing it. And, you know, as society changes and as the needs of the people, you know, the population that the martial art is being practiced and changed, then martial art changes too, you know. And there are people that are hyper-traditionalists that try to, I know there are, you know, like Japanese jiu-jitsu schools out there that try to practice something that's a little bit closer to the way that jiu-jitsu would have been practiced, you know, traditionally in Japan. But they're a little bit of like of an oddity, you know, honestly, in the martial arts world. They by no means represent a majority. And I think people like that are important, though. You know, the idea, everybody's got different things that drive them and interest them about the martial arts. And, you know, if you're the kind of person that's really just fascinated by the historical aspect of it, that you're practicing, you know, something that's a part of history with that, too. I think that's cool. That's what interests you. That's what you want to do. But the reality is that, you know, the reason why jiu-jitsu isn't generally practiced the way that it was back then is because society has changed so drastically since then that, you know, there's no longer a need for it. And to bring this back, I've been reading a lot of old karate books. And I think that often, you know, when you look at the way that karate was practiced in the past and you compare it to, you know, like the Olympics style, like point karate that you see today. I mean, it's a night and day difference. They're so different. But it's not really surprising that an art would evolve that way, because, I mean, the reality is that you have, you know, what's the assault? You know, how common are criminal assaults in Japan today?
Japan is probably one of the safest countries. So.
In the world, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so, but, Edmund, so I think it's
amen.
I mean, I've been to Japan, and I've been to, I believe I was in what is considered a rough neighborhood in Japan, and I felt no fear of any criminal activity happening to me at all.
I was in Japan when I was like 15 too, and I remember it being just like literally, like, you feel like you could eat off the streets. It was you know, the point is, though, but even, you know, taking into account Japan, it's a particularly safe country. Even the United States, which compared to a lot of other developed countries has a higher, you know, crime rate. And it depends on where you are. There are parts of this country, of course, that are very dangerous. But for the most part, you know, it compare, especially compared historically to where to violence, to the prevalence of violence in previous times, it's like we're living in a safe environment. Well, all things considered, there's not nearly the need for self-defense that there used to be. That in a place like, and again, I am not an authority with historically. I don't know how violent, you know, pre-modern Okinawa exactly was.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that you develop a martial art because you really need it. You know, it's like that you are likely to have to fight and defend yourself every day. That's just not the situation that most martial artists find themselves in today. That the reality is, like, you and I, you know, kind of adult men living on the East Coast in the United States and relatively safe environments, stuff like that. It's like, hey, it's not that it can't happen. It's not that I don't want to be prepared for it. I absolutely want to have the ability to defend myself and to defend the people around me if the need arises. But I also recognize that the reality is that, you know, I probably won't have to do that more than a handful of times in my life, something like that. So then what is the majority of martial arts practice for? That's when it leads to this evolution of the art. Well, it's like, well, it's a form of, everybody needs a form of exercise, something to do to keep you healthy and active. Everybody needs also things that they just enjoy doing, they like doing. It's a hobby, it's an interest that you have. And that's the direction that the art tends to take.
Yeah, I agree. And again, the entertainment aspect of it has become more and more popular. And so I'm going to go to boxing as an example. Like, boxing, in my opinion, is lots of times not considered a martial art. In my opinion, it is. And it's one of the more effective styles of punching that you can work on.
Best punchers in the world, for sure.
So, but the thing is that it has become an entertainment and a sport at such a level that, like, even though it can be used for self-defense, I don't think that the thought of doing boxing for self-defense enters into anybody's mind.
Sure.
Like, I don't know if I've ever met a person that's like, hey, I'm doing boxing for self-defense.
Yeah.
It's either I do boxing because I want to be a boxer, or I'm doing it to get fit. And it's, and like, that's the thing, is that the spectacle has kind of overtaken it, lots of training it for self-defense. Because if you were to train boxing for self-defense, obviously you'd focus on the defensive tactics and the offensive tactics, but you would also talk a little bit about how do I avoid getting clinched, which I think that happens in boxing, but also how do I avoid getting tackled? So you work on sprawling.
Sure. The clinching in boxing, though, is very different, you know, because, I mean, there's all kinds of things with the sport, you know, and you wear gloves.
Exactly.
You
know,
so you can't really grab each other the same way.
You tape your hands and wrists so that you can throw with more power. So all those things are definitely a factor. Like, you know, I mean, my understanding of boxing, which again, I'm not no historian on boxing, is that it was originally done bare knuckle.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And that changes everything.
So the one guy I've trained with a lot, I've talked about often on this podcast, Ian Abernethy, you know, great martial artist, somebody whose work I've followed very closely for years now. He often talks about a little bit of history of boxing, how like the first, and I don't have the information on hand, I could look it up, but like the first recorded boxing match in English history was like, first it was a sword fight, then they fought with sticks, and then they fought barehanded, and like it ended with like a takedown, like, you know, like that's how they ended. That it was like, so that's where boxing started. That would, I think that would have been like the 1700s, you know, so like very old type thing. So you see and we actually talked about this in the very first episode of this podcast, specialization.
Yeah.
Now, the idea, like, boxing, great martial art, you know, I would absolutely say that the level of punching that's developed by professional boxers is, I mean, there's no, that's best punchers in the world. However, it is the art of punching, you know, just punching. And that's what the point of specialization often is if you choose one skill set, and then we just elevate that skill set to a super high level. You know, you develop the, you know, much better. Like, it's like with MMA, often you talk about it. Are there good boxers in MMA? Sure. Yeah. Are they going to be able to, like, beat the best boxers in the world? No, of course not. Because those guys are practicing just punching. It's the art of punching by itself.
to go even more extreme on this, let's talk about professional wrestling, as in WWE, WWF, yeah. Professional wrestling, because the thing is that, so now, again, it is purely entertainment,
mm-hmm.
and I would say probably 80% of the moves, maybe even more, have nothing that even resembles something that has a lineage of coming from actual fighting.
Yeah.
But professional wrestling actually started from the concept of actual wrestlers
mm-hmm.
doing worked matches. So the outcome was determined.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they would do actual wrestling, and they would put each other in actual submission holds and just not put enough pressure to hurt each other.
Yeah.
But it was just that with a fixed outcome to build up a legend. And every once in a while, because my understanding, again, of the history of this is that they would go to carnivals and travel around. Every once in a while, they might have an open match, and then they would work somebody over for real. They would,
sure.
They would actually take them down and work them into a submission hold and get them to say, I give up. But lots of the times, it was a worked match. So even if it was like, hey, I'm traveling in this group, mm-hmm. and we're doing a tour of Germany, carnival tour, and I'm doing these, hey, open matches, it's predetermined who the person is coming up there for the match, even if I say open challenge to anyone.
Yeah.
Right? But everything was legitimate. Well, then what started to happen at one point is that somebody was like, well, instead of making every move legitimate, what if we fake this thing because it looks cool? Even though it has no practical use, it looks cool. And then from there, it started to build more into the,
yeah.
Well, this thing looks cool, so let's do this thing. Okay, this looks cool. And to the point where it eventually built up to being strictly entertainment. I'm not a huge historian on fake wrestling, but I believe that full shift of it being completely artificial, I believe maybe happened in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, I've it's history I'm not particularly familiar with, though I have read a little bit about that, specifically with like the shoot fighting in Japan.
Yeah.
I've read that like the lines very much were blurred between what was shoot fighting, what was professional wrestling. Because it was a lot of the same guys.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a lot of the same guys, right? Like they're like doing actual fighting, but then they're also doing like entertainment, you know, professional wrestling.
That still happens a lot more in Japan than it does anywhere else in the world. It happens less now in Japan than it has in the past.
Yeah.
But like even like a guy like Kazushi Sakuraba, who's one of the top guys in the world in MMA in the late 90s, early 2000s, he was doing worked.
And considered himself a professional wrestler.
Professional wrestling match. And the guy that he was underneath was a guy named Takada and the Takada Dojo. Well, that guy had two matches in Japan against Hicks and Gracie, but that guy's just a professional wrestler with no actual training.
Yeah.
And then at some point he beat a guy named Mark Coleman. Some of you guys, again, look these names up if you want. Mark Coleman is a legitimate American wrestler, a legitimate MMA fighter. Well, they had a fake match mm-hmm. in Pride, which was a work where Takada caught Mark Coleman in a leg lock, but it was a predetermined match.
Yeah.
But they were pretending it wasn't. So the lines have always been blurred a lot more. But that's traditionally what happened in these work matches. So there's actually a book that my friend Eugene Robinson wrote, who hopefully one day we'll have on this podcast, called Fight, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Fighting, But We're Afraid You Get Your Ass Kicked for Asking.
It's and a great title.
There is a conversation that he has in there about worked matches. And specifically the person he's talking to talks about a boxing match, which legend has it was a worked match. And he says, well, just because it's a worked match doesn't mean you're not going to get hit for real.
Oh, sure.
And people don't realize that. And that has been kind of what a large amount of controversy is in some of these combat sports. Well, it's like, because there's still conspiracy theories with stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Especially since things are entertainment. So
you hear it all the time, like every UFC fight.
Floyd Mayweather versus Conor McGregor, there's people that have said multiple times, and Floyd has done nothing but lead to more speculation on it, that I carried Conor McGregor for the fans so there would be more entertainment and we'd have the option of doing a second match.
Sure.
So I carried him across whatever amount of rounds, it was 10 rounds or something like that, I think. And I could have finished him in the first round if I wanted to. So now that leads to the speculation of, well, was it all work?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Or did... So you don't know, but again, it's entertainment, and the promoter doesn't care as long as it sells. And that's where you see things in MMA,
yeah,
where a guy is like a monster and he's beating everybody, but they're like, nobody wants to watch you fight, so you're not going to get a title shot. Or to get a title shot, you're legitimately going to have to beat every person we put in front of you.
Yeah.
And maybe if you do like 20 wins in a row, we'll give you that title shot. There's a guy named John Fitch who used to fight in the UFC that is legitimately the case.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he won 22 fights in a row. Nobody wanted to watch him fight. He legitimately beat every person. The only person he couldn't beat at the time was George St. Pierre. And that's the guy he eventually got the title shot just because he was beating everyone.
Sure.
And then after he lost to George St. Pierre, he had a couple matches. He beat a couple good guys again. But the thing that kept on coming up was, well, why aren't you getting another shot at the title? And he's like, well, Dana White says nobody wants to watch me fight.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, well, that's correct. Nobody wants to watch you fight because nobody thinks what you do is interesting.
Well, it's always been something with MMA, and the UFC specifically.
But it's bigger than MMA.
They don't really operate as like a sporting league as much as an entertainment kind of thing.
The same thing's true of boxing, though, or anything. Yeah. You know, again, and that's the reason why collegiate wrestling, which is real wrestling, or Olympic wrestling, or the world championships, or whatever you want to call it, freestyle Greco-Roman, is not as popular as the WWF.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Like if we said, hey, we're going to have Cale Sanderson in his prime, who's one of the greatest American wrestlers of all time, take on John Smith, who's one of the greatest American wrestlers of all time, we can somehow get them both at their peaks. And we're going to have them face off. And at the same time, we're going to have Hulk Hogan versus Stone Cold Steve Austin face off. More people are going to watch Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Hulk Hogan than they're going to watch Cale Sanderson versus John Smith. That's just the way it works.
Yeah.
More people know who The Rock is than Dan Gable. Dan Gable is one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. But that is entertaining to people that grapple, or people that have family members or friends that grapple and
yeah,
real grappling, where Hulk Hogan in the WWF versus Macho Man Randy Savage, that's pure entertainment. And maybe those guys are, you know, super tough and they actually do know how to fight. Who knows? I believe some of them used to. And again, in traditionally, more of those guys were actually doing what kind of was catch wrestling.
Yeah.
And then it became a little bit of catch wrestling, which is, again, wrestling with just submissions. It became a little bit more of catch wrestling with these moves that are strictly for show. And then, again, eventually it shifted into, let's do all show.
Yeah, no, well, hey, man, and I've talked about on here before about, like, point fighting for karate. As somebody who has spent many years practicing a lot of karate point fighting, and I don't like watching it. I can absolutely understand how it's like, there are some sports that are not really spectator friendly. They're not particularly entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
You know, they might, and not to say I didn't enjoy doing point fighting. I did, you know, it's like, it's not like any athletic pursuit, any competitive, you know, thing. It's like, it's a lot that I learned from it, a lot that I gained from it, and a lot that I appreciate about it. However, in terms of like the entertainment value of something like that, it's like, yeah, it's like, because, you know, it's light contact. You know, it's like people aren't trying to knock each other out. It's just like a game. It's like karate tag. It's all you're playing. It's like, it's a legitimate sport. It's going to be in the Olympics next year. You know, everything. It's not anything wrong with that. But I totally understand, like, why would anyone watch this if they aren't, like, if it isn't something that they do a lot themselves. Like, it's the only people I imagine being in. I imagine jiu-jitsu is kind of similar. You know, like watching a jiu-jitsu match.
Yeah,
you know, it's
like that.
Like, how many people that have no grappling experience at all will be really into that?
I think that there's some things that are being done in the grappling world to make it more spectator-friendly, but it's still very much in the developmental stages.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a cool event called Quintet, which is almost like, For those of you that have watched professional wrestling, it's kind of like Survivor Series. So Survivor Series had like a team of wrestlers get together.
Yeah.
So Quintet is a format that Kazushi Sakuraba is actually largely responsible for, where you have a team of five grapplers and you just need to be under the total amount of weight. So they go, hey, the total amount of weight for the team is 1,200 pounds. You divide that amongst the five of you, whichever way you want. I don't know if 1,200 pounds is the actual weight, but I'm just throwing out.
That's interesting. Interesting.
And then it's like, you decide the order, how you guys want to go. But if you win your match, you just keep keep going until you lose. Once you lose, you're eliminated. And I think sometimes it's you're eliminated, period, and sometimes they do it where you can come back if your team wins the next round.
Interesting. But
it's like, if you're good enough that you can beat all five guys, you beat all five guys, they lost.
Yeah.
If you win two matches and then you lose your third, you're out, and then the next person in the line comes out.
It's interesting because of the strategy involved. I know, so I'll give you a little bit of point karate type stuff, which is very amateur sport, but yeah, sometimes we'll do something called team fighting. It's similar, yeah, where and the way that the tournaments I would do, I practice Tung Sudo, which is Korean style of karate, so kind of East Coast. Tung Sudo people know exactly what I'm talking about. We do tournaments where the team fighting, you'll have, the way it's generally done, there's some variations, is you'll be on a team of three. And we usually do cumulative points. So, you know, it'll be like a 90 second round, you know, the first two competitors will go.
Yeah.
And then that, the score carries over to the next round, to the next round. And it's interesting because it gives you some strategy with it too, that, you know, you want to have a wide range of kind of skill sets going there, that, you know, you want to have guys that are able to handle different types of fighters.
Yeah.
That you're able to, and the strategy too about, like, you know, one team will put out their fighter first, and then that team will have to choose who they're going to go against with the two. So you're like, you know, you're able to kind of like decide, like, hey, you know, you're the guy to fight,
yeah,
to
yeah,
fight
yeah.
him. You know, it's interesting stuff. So just to bring it back to where this conversation started with the evolution of styles, you know, it's just something that's been on my mind lately because I've been reading these old karate books, and I think it's cool to look at like a martial arts style as being a living thing. You know, it's like a living organism, the way that a style grows and changes over time, and how we all as individual practitioners contribute to it to some extent and decide the direction that you want the style to go. Something that I think is often, that's a little bit of a problem specifically in the karate world, is sometimes things get too, the styles split too much, where it's yeah. like, and karate people here, anybody who's not a karate person listening to this, you know, they may not quite understand what I mean by that, but like there's hundreds of karate styles and they're
yeah.
all like, you know, very different. Like we practice
so,
different forms, different kata, different training methods. They look very different.
I think that that's more just a cultural thing for the times that we live in. So
yeah.
I'm going to come back to music
yeah.
as an example of this, which is that like in music, like there was a time where I'm going to use metal because that's this thing that I'm most familiar with.
Yeah.
Where if you played anything that fell under the subgenre of metal, you were just a metal band.
Yeah.
And if you played anything that fell under the subgenre of rock, you were a rock band.
Yeah.
If you played anything that's under the subgenre of jazz, you played jazz. If you played anything under pop, you were just pop. If you played anything that resembled blues, you were blues. And
yeah.
it was like, to a certain extent, it was that simple. But then it started to become, well, the style of metal you're playing is slower than the style of metal that we play. So you're doom metal, and you're thrash metal.
yeah.
And then you're
yeah.
speed metal.
Sludge
your
metal.
Your crossover
yeah.
metal. Your sludge metal.
Yeah.
Your post metal. And then it's like in jazz, no, your elevator music, your jazz, your soft jazz.
Yeah.
You're like with pop music, it's okay, instead of it just being pop, oh, you play electropop, you play EDM, you play rock pop, whatever. Like, again, all the things, your soft rock, your hard rock, your alternative rock. For whatever reason, the need and the desire for segregation of what people are doing is more and more.
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, if we talk to somebody who did yoga back in 1990 and you ask them what they did, they would just say, I do yoga. But if you ask somebody in 2020, what yoga, oh, do you do yoga? They start saying, like, oh, I do blank style. I'm not super familiar with yoga, but they're
sure.
gonna say I do this style of yoga.
Yeah, Bikram and
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Like I do Bikram
yeah,
yoga.
Yeah.
I do. I don't know. What's one of the other
vinyasa,
yeah. Ashtanga. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah,
yeah. Like they're like boom. I do this, bang. Like I say this all the time with jiu-jitsu. Like there's this, even in jiu-jitsu, there's this like need to, for people to be like, oh, I do Gracie jiu-jitsu, which means it's more self-defense.
I do 10th planet.
I do 10th planet jiu-jitsu. I do no-gi jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
you just do jujitsu. Like these ideas of that things are relatively young. People, like, if you talk to somebody who was doing jujitsu in the United States in 1998, they just did jujitsu.
Sure. Yeah. Well, this actually leads exactly. So, you know, again, talking about Gichin Funakoshi, father of modern karate, he was kind of, and he was the founder of one of the biggest karate styles known as Shotokan.
Yeah.
One of the things about Shotokan, though, is that it was like, that was his pen name that Funakoshi went by. He would sometimes sign things as Shotokan like that.
Yeah.
He never had the intention of Shotokan being a separate style. It was his students after him that created, you know, the Shotokan as we think of it today. Again, so they often say about Shotokan karate that it's really more like Nakayama. He was one of the head of the Japanese Karate Association, one of the biggest karate associations in the world to this day, but especially in its golden age, you know, it was like kind of like all of Japan and a lot of, you know, Western countries too were united under this one organization. Really, like, it was Nakayama's, at least my impression of history, is really Nakayama's vision, much more so than Funakoshi's, the way the Shotokan karate that you see of today.
Yeah.
But Funakoshi himself was against the idea of styles in karate. And that's something that I definitely, and a lot from Ian Abernethy again, something that I got from his influence as well, where I think that there's a lot of value when you stop, because, you know, there's a little bit of an arrogance sometimes that comes with styles. Everybody has this idea that what they do is better.
Well,
it's more pure.
Think that's a large part of the reason why people need the segregation is because they're trying to win lots of times an imaginary battle, because it's not a real battle where what they do is superior.
Sure. And I think that it's a mistake a lot of times. I think that's something that helped me a lot as a martial artist, is when I just started to identify more as like, just, I'm a karate practitioner in general, not I'm Tung Sudo practitioner. I do Tung Sudo, which means I only do these things, and I don't do those things that those other styles of karate do, because they do it wrong. And what I do is better than what they do. So why would I bother to learn from what they're doing? I think that kind of mentality, I think the term it's used towards sometimes is like a style limitation.
Yeah.
That you're limiting. I think that styles are a really interesting idea when you look at it as this living thing that's always changing as time goes on, and that as the current generation of practitioners that we are contributing to, and we're determining in some ways as individuals the direction that, you know, our martial art is taking based on the direction that we take in our own training. I think that's a really powerful, interesting idea. I think that when a style becomes a limitation, where it's more that, like, I do this and only this, and it doesn't need to change or grow or develop in a healthy direction. It's perfect just the way that it is, and I just want to preserve it forever. Again, I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to be judgmental towards people, and I even talked about it earlier on in this episode, where was talking about like historical martial arts, people that want to practice something as like an historical art, that they're preserving something that was a part of history. And, you know, if that's what interests you and what you like about your practice, then more power to you. You know, go for it. However, I think that for most people, the more embrace martial art as something that's changing, that, you know, it's based on what you want to get out of your practice. You'll change your approach to it a little bit. And I think that's where you start to see, you know, maybe looking not at like a specific style of karate, but karate as a bigger thing. This is the whole of the karate world, as it's something that's always changing and developing. And, you know, you can look at it historically, reading these books, you see where karate kind of the modern style, karate as a modern martial art, you can see where it started like close to 100 years ago now. And then you can see how it developed into more of a health and a health and wellness type pursuit, the idea of physical and mental development, and then it developed into a sport. And now you have in modern day, you know, something that I've followed very closely for a number of years now, which is what they call the practical karate movement, where, you know, you have a lot of practitioners who learn the art as a method of health and of physical and mental development, or as a sport. And now they're trying to take it back to its roots, which is where most martial arts start, as something that's for kind of combat, some kind of real combat. And I just find it something I personally like a lot about my own training, is the idea that you're part of something of a living thing like that, that you're contributing to the style of karate, the style of martial arts practice, It's always changing and always evolving.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that kind of the bigger thing is that it's a competitive thing for most people, I think.
Yeah.
Of like being like, I need to say what I do is the best. And I don't know if sometimes it's a like an ego driven thing of like wanting to be like the alpha dog that dominates people,
yeah.
Or sometimes it's about, hey, I want to make more money. So if I say that my thing is most effective and can prove it's most effective,
sure.
That from like a business perspective, I can corner a market and get these people to pay me money. Whereas I think like, you know, if depending on what you're training for, you kind of just want to take whatever's the best thing that you can get, which is like, you know, like if you're, let's say you are a competitive jiu-jitsu athlete, if there's something from wrestling, which is a different grappling style that you can take and use and win with, take and use it. And then
sure.
Have no shame in saying, hey, this is a wrestling move. Or, hey, I did judo and I learned this in judo. Or I learned this in a catch wrestling thing that I did.
That's another way of looking at it. You know, like, so you can look at karate. You know, there are different styles of karate. You can look at karate as just its own, just as one thing.
Yeah.
But then also it's the interaction between other styles. And like, you know, the way I've been training with you and Alberto with trying to bring some kind of grappling, some form, like I want more formal grappling experience in my own skill sets so that I can be a better teacher and that I can teach, you know, though it's been like kind of a long-term goal of mine for a while now, put on a little bit on hold because of the coronavirus, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, I want to be able to teach basic groundwork to my students. And that's actually maybe a good example of like how style is a living, growing, evolving thing. Is that I teach my students basic groundwork and make it a part of what my school does. And then maybe I have a student, a couple of students that decide to be teachers themselves. And that's part of what they do. And they bring that. And then, you know, you look at, and this is what's interesting about thinking, like looking, what's interesting about looking at karate's past for me is it makes me understand a little bit about like where the future can go exactly. It's that 100 years from now, maybe groundwork will be a well-established part of karate. Because of people like me and a lot of other practitioners out there who recognize that there's a need for it. And if I'm telling my students, I'm teaching them to defend themselves, I can't just neglect entirely what you do when you find out when you're on the ground. That way, then, you know, it becomes a part of the art in that way.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode and keep training.
Yeah, take care, guys.